go to our recording. So I appreciate the technical assistance. So go ahead and we'll get started.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Recording in progress.
Okay, well, thank you, Bob, Brandon, Hyland, and our technical folks that help keep things running here for our webinar. I'm Don Natoli, and today I'll get to be the host and chair for your Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting of March 28, 2022. And when I first express our appreciation and thanks to our media past chair, Susan Tatayan from the Delta Stewardship Council, who left state service a few weeks ago, but I know that Susan had chaired these meetings for several years now, and certainly appreciate her service on the council and also her service with the committee and the good work this committee has undertaken, certainly over the past several years. So with that, we just would announce too that our meeting clerk is, we have both Brandon and Eric that will help if we need to move folks over, and we'll assist with obviously the agenda movement as we go through it today. And I'll then now turn to, now calling our webinar to order, I'll turn to Amanda to run through some introductions. I have a few announcements to make, and I know we have some panelists, and so we'll move down through our agenda to get to those panelists as quickly as possible. So with that, Amanda, good afternoon, and I'll turn it over to you for our introductions.
Great. Thank you, Supervisor and Chair Natoli. Glad to be with you all here today. I'm going to just call on folks and ask you to introduce yourself and the organization that you're representing today. And I will be, just for the sake of time, just calling on kind of the primary representative that I see here in the room for the agency. So I think we'll start with Larry.
Hi, Larry Goldspan, Executive Director of the Bay Conservation Development Commission.
Hi, Larry. Campbell.
Everyone, Campbell Ingram, Executive Officer of the Delta Conservancy.
Laurel.
Laurel Larson, Delta Lead Scientist.
Jane Reed.
Hi, Jane Reed from the U.S. Geological Survey for California, Arizona, and Nevada.
Thanks, Jane. Lenny Grimaldo.
Andy Grimaldo, Assistant Environmental Director for DWR, filling in for Carla and Cindy today.
Tim Ramirez.
Good afternoon, Tim Ramirez, Central Valley Flood Protection Board.
Thanks. Brian Thompson. I saw Brian pop up. Are you there, Brian? US EPA.
Hey, man. I'm
okay,
Brian,
sorry.
I'm having issues. There he is.
Sorry about that. I had pushed too many buttons. Brian Thompson, US EPA, San Francisco Regional Office.
Thanks, Brian. And I saw you there too, Ellen. Thank you for being here. Ernest Ponet.
Yeah, Ernest Conant, Regional Director, Bureau of Reclamation.
Thank you. Virginia Madueño.
Good afternoon, everybody. Virginia Madueño, currently serving as Vice Chair for the Delta Stewardship Council. And my apologies, my video is working. However, a little under the weather, bad allergies, not good, not a good hair day.
Well, your picture really is great, Virginia.
Thanks, Don. Good to be here.
Kaylee Allen.
Hi, Kaylee Allen, Assistant Regional Director for Fish and Aquatic Conservation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Joaquin Esquivel.
Hey everyone, Joaquin Esquivel here, Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, and I'm joined by Michael George, our Delta Water Master. I'll have to duck out in about 30 minutes, but it's good to be able to be here with you all at the start.
Great. Thank you, Joaquin, and thank you, Michael, for being here. Jennifer Norris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer Norris, Deputy Secretary at the California Natural Resources Agency. I'm subbing in for Nancy Vogel and Wade Crowfoot. Hi, everyone.
Thanks, Jennifer. And Cindy Tejeda.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Tejeda from the South Pacific Division of the Corps of Engineers, filling in for Josephine Ext.
Thank you, Cindy. And did I miss anyone, any agency?
Hey, Amanda, this is Kathy Marcinkiewicz with NOAA Fisheries. I'm the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Central Valley office here for Scott Rumsey, who is our Acting Regional Administrator.
Great. Thank you, Kathy. Oh, and Anna Neymark.
Hi, everybody. Anna Neymark, Deputy Secretary for Water at California EPA, filling in for Secretary Blumenfeld.
Thank you, Anna.
And this is Gary Gold. I'm with the Department of the Interior and new to this group, and wanted to say we appreciate the efforts and support our team at Reclamation and everything that is going on with, you know, with this, you know, this important issue. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, I was going to introduce Gary. He's a newly appointed Deputy Assistant Secretary. And as you know, that office oversees Reclamation and the USGS. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
All right, Chair Natoli, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, thank you, Amanda. And thanks to all the folks that have joined in today. Certainly, this is a pretty high-powered committee, hearing the titles and the agencies and various organizations that you represent. So we're glad to have you all with us and appreciate the time spent here this afternoon. Real quickly, then, we would typically open up the implementation committee meetings by just asking the committee members if they have any critical updates to share, certainly since we last gathered, and we do have some new folks. So this would be an opportunity if you wanted to share. Now it's time to do it. Otherwise, we'll continue down to the program. So Amanda, I don't see any hands. Do you see any hands? Okay. All right. Very good. Well, if something occurs to you before we're done, certainly interject as we go through the agenda. So thank you, committee members. Let me just take a moment. So for those members of the public, because this is a webinar, we do have members of the public that are, I'm sure, tuned in. I want just to note that if any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please be as kind to send us an email or a blue card to the clerk, and you'll see it up on the screen, but just to read it into the record, at engage at deltacouncil.ca.gov. Also, be sure to note that your name and the agenda item that you wish to speak to. Please note as well, if you wish to actually speak or would like the clerk to read your comment into the record, please do this as soon as possible so that there's time for the clerk to send the link to you to join the meeting if you're not already joined. And then when called, the clerk will unmute you or read your comment as requested. I think it goes without saying, but please be courteous during this process. Again, thank you, and we welcome public comments as we go through the agenda today. So then before we actually move to our first panel, this is an opportunity to the committee members to look back to the summary of the October 2021 DPIC meeting summary, which aren't necessarily minutes, but they're notes of the meeting, and if there's any additions or modifications that any committee member wishes to note, this is the time to do that. I don't know, Amanda, if you had any comments on the notes.
I have not received any written comments on the notes, and I don't see any hands up right now.
Okay, so these are just summary notes. They don't require any action by the committee, but for the record, again, a summary of the commentary and discussions that were taken in at the last DPIC meeting. Okay, and without any further ado, we're going to move to our first presentation of the day, and we have a panel, a very distinguished panel, on the collaboration across the estuary, and I believe Larry Goldsband is going to moderate, introduce the panelists, and actually bring the panel to a close, and then we'll take public comment at the end of it. But I know we have some distinguished speakers here, as we do on some of the other items, and so, Amanda, unless there's anything you want to add, we're going to go right to Larry and let you take the reins here, Larry. And thank you for being so kind as to moderate today's panel. We're looking forward to it.
Thank you, Chair Natoli. So, given the massive drought that weighs heavily on everybody's mind, much less what's going on in Ukraine, it may seem almost trivial that we want to discuss how different elements of the DPIC are working collaboratively across the estuary on various important scientific and social issues. So you may think that what we're going to talk about during the next hour will seem like we're cooking steaks on the stove during a house fire. But we do think that it's important to demonstrate that delta-centric and bay-centric forces can and must work together so that we can improve the long-term environmental, social, and economic health of the entire estuary in both dry and wet times. So first I'll make an admission. I work in a very different place than most of you. Historically, people who live and work in the Delta think that just about everybody in the Bay Area either ignore, make fun of, or avoid thinking about the Delta. But you know one group of people who live in the Bay Area whose members think about the Delta and the estuary? Airline pilots. They can look down and see the rivers flowing from the Sierras through the valley into the Delta and into the Bay, and they see one system. So far as I know, BCDC has never had a commissioner who is a commercial pilot. But because you were kind enough to ask me to become a DPIC member, BCDC is starting to look east, and we're starting to develop a strong collaboration and we hope a long-term partnership with the Delta Stewardship Council. And that relationship will be based on sound science and respect for a healthy environment and populace. Climate change requires that. So does the need to adopt solutions that treat all people fairly. Conservation science doesn't discriminate among different populations. And what we learn as BCDC's collaborative rising sea level adaptation program navigates through our 9 counties and 46 cities and scores of special districts. Likely we'll teach the Delta Adapt team some lessons and vice versa. So right now we're going to introduce you to 5 different people who are working at 4 organizations, examining 5 different aspects of what you all do. And each will describe for you how their success will result from collaborating with people across the estuary. It's not so simple, but we think that each of you as leaders of your organizations can learn from these stories and apply them so that all of our organizations can be even more successful from vantage points throughout the estuary. With that, I want to introduce Caitlin Sweeney, who is Executive Director of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership. She will lead off and provide an overview of many of these issues, and then we'll take a deeper dive. So Caitlin, off to you.
Thank you so much, Larry. Thank you, Chair Natoli and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm going to bring up my slides. So again, I'm Caitlin Sweeney. I'm the director of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the San Francisco Estuary Blueprint. But before I do, before I launch into it, I just want to give a little bit of background on the Estuary Partnership for those of you who may be less familiar with us, as I think it's been a few years since I've presented to this body. So the Estuary Partnership is a place-based non-regulatory program of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So we're one of 28 members of the National Estuary Program, which was established by Congress in the late 1980s to essentially protect and restore estuaries of national significance. And the National Estuary Program model really focuses on local partnerships, on collaboration, and on consensus building. So we leverage funding and partnerships to support various efforts to protect, enhance, and restore the estuary system. And we work with a large suite of diverse partners to do so. This map shows the planning area of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership. So you can see that we cover the entire bay and the delta up to the legal delta, as well as the watersheds that drain to the estuary. This is a terrible slide, I know, but it's just meant to list our own implementation committee. Like you, we are guided by a 38-member implementation committee, which includes representatives from local, state, and federal agencies, businesses, and environmental and citizen advocacy organizations. The implementation committee works with me in determining partnership priorities, and they also approve and implement the Estuary Blueprint. And we're really pleased and grateful to have representation on the implementation committee spanning the entire estuary. And actually, Amanda Bowl is currently serving, thankfully, her second term as our vice chair. So thank you to her. We also have an executive council that provides more broad policy direction and also approves and helps implement the Estuary Blueprint. And you can see there's a great deal of overlap between the executive council and the DPIC. So I'll transition now to talking specifically about the estuary blueprint. The blueprint is a non-regulatory regional collaborative planning document. It's actually required by the Clean Water Act, with the very bureaucratic and technical name of the Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, a mouthful. The Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan for the San Francisco Estuary, what we now call the Estuary Blueprint, was initially released in 1993. And at that time, it served as the first collaborative plan for the estuary developed by over 100 stakeholder groups, many of whom before then had really never sat down at the table together to agree on priorities. Since 93, the plan has undergone several updates over time, and it still serves as the most comprehensive plan for the ecological health of the entire estuary. So the most recent update to the plan is undergoing final approvals and should be released this spring, the 2022 Estuary Blueprint. The current version of the blueprint is both a regional vision, asking ourselves where we want to be in 2050, and also an actionable strategy for what we can do over the next 5 years to get there. And the 2022 blueprint provides a roadmap for restoring the health of the estuary, addressing its chemical, physical, biological, and social ecological processes. The blueprint has four goals or focus areas broadly reflected here with the four circles, but the real work happens at the action level. 25 actions bridge across these focus areas. And what the blueprint does is really serve to elevate those five-year priority actions for support and potential funding for project and program development and implementation. This slide just lists in shorthand the 25 actions of the Estuary Blueprint, the 2022 Estuary Blueprint, just so you can see the breadth of topics covered in the blueprint. So now zooming back out to the higher level intentions and tenets of the blueprint. I should probably count up the number of times I say collaboration or collaborative every time I give one of these presentations, but that really is the essence of the blueprint. It takes a comprehensive and a collaborative approach to laying out a shared regional vision and action plan. So the current blueprint, about to be released, is a result of a 2-year process with input from close to 200 collaborating partners. And then in the resulting document, there are about 150 discrete entities identified in the blueprint as leads or collaborating partners on specific tasks. So in advancing the goals of the blueprint, we aim to break down silos by bringing diverse voices together and actively supporting new partnerships. The blueprint identifies and elevates the highest priority actions needed now to ensure that we can all enjoy a thriving, resilient estuary into the future. To that end, the blueprint certainly prioritizes climate resilience. It does so in a variety of ways, including by identifying ways to protect natural resources, such as tidal marshes, as an integral part of any effort to increase the resilience of shoreline communities at risk from flooding and rising seas. Also by increasing the pace and scale of shoreline habitat restoration projects, by tackling challenges such as funding and regulatory processes, and by facilitating innovative shoreline climate adaptation strategies that can provide multiple benefits, including flood protection, improved water quality, habitat, and open space and recreational opportunities. And we're doing all of this, of course, with a real sense of urgency as we see the impacts of climate change and sea level rise escalating throughout our region and beyond, and particularly in underserved and frontline communities who are already at greater risk due to location, and a legacy of environmental injustices. The people who live, work, and play along the estuary are part of its history and its future. And we know that the health of the estuary and the health of the people surrounding it are inextricably linked. And of course, many of the same drivers that put the health and function of the estuary so at risk have also placed certain communities at risk and have resulted in disproportionate impacts to frontline communities, tribal groups and indigenous people and people of color. And of course, the benefits of all of our work to protect and restore and enhance the estuary are not distributed or accessed equitably. So whether we're talking about the quality of drinking water, contaminants in the fish that people eat, proximity to open space and the associated health benefits of that, or even just overall resilience to climate change. So the blueprint highlights that nexus of social and ecological resilience as we look toward the future. The blueprint walks a sometimes tricky line between aspirational yet feasible, also between being strategic and opportunistic, right? Zeroing in on the most important known actions while also allowing for emerging issues and those innovative solutions that we haven't yet identified. We all need to push ourselves to do more, faster, better. We should be ambitious. And yet we also don't want to reach so high that we accomplish nothing. So I often think of it in this way, or characterize it in this way. If we had all the funding we needed, all the capacity required, all the partnerships in place, we should be able to implement all the actions in the blueprint within its 5-year timeframe. Aspirational, but feasible. And the blueprint acknowledges a shared responsibility for solutions, again, collaborative. The Estuary Partnership and the Estuary Blueprint serve a coordinating function that bring together a diversity of stakeholders to facilitate, you know, what we hope to be a really synchronized effort to achieve our common goals. And to that end, we're all invested and we hold all of us accountable. The blueprint is actionable and it's measurable. We have identified milestones and lead partners and collaborators. We have an elaborate tracking system to measure progress, and we have a feedback system to track changes in environmental health through the State of the Estuary report. And we have a variety of forums to share both quantitative and qualitative results, calling attention to the challenges and really celebrating all of our successes. And finally, I want to end with one of the most critical and honestly, one of the most challenging aspects of the blueprint and the theme of today's panel. And that is that the blueprint strives to take an integrated approach, coordinating across geographies and systems and across plans and topic areas. On a localized scale, the blueprint advances integration across landscapes, connecting our uplands with our wetlands, our tributaries with their floodplains, seeking to restore complete ecosystems and supporting the science that we need to do that. And then more broadly, the blueprint looks at the Bay and the Delta as one interconnected ecological system, and the actions really attempt to incorporate that holistic view wherever possible. And in doing so, the blueprint supports, aligns, and advances other planning efforts throughout the region, really highlighting those highest priority cross-jurisdictional, cross-system issues with the health of the estuary as our common foundation. So the 2022 blueprint, for example, supports and advances element of the Bay ADAPT Joint Platform and Delta ADAPTS, the Delta Plan, and many other efforts. Estuary Partnership staff worked really closely with all kinds of staff from our Delta partner entities during this latest blueprint update, as increased Bay Delta integration was a specific guiding principle of the update. And I think we were successful in several key areas where the blueprint has made good progress in taking a more holistic view by advancing an integrated cross-estuary approach where possible or highlighting opportunities for learning across the region. Climate resilience is one area that I've already touched on, including planning on both regional and local scales and implementing climate adaptation projects. The blueprint also includes a focus on equity, weaving tasks addressing equity considerations throughout all of the actions, as well as including a new action focused specifically on supporting the role that Indigenous and frontline communities play in promoting estuary health and resilience. And that action advances equity through regional strategies, including growing capacity for community organizations with deep roots in frontline and underserved communities, and also developing best management practices for habitat restoration and nature-based shoreline adaptation projects in partnership with tribal and community partners. And you'll be hearing more on the topic of environmental justice and equity from panelist Moy Moreno Rivera in a little bit. Advancing nutrient management in the estuary is certainly a cross-cutting action, including tasks related to long-term monitoring and modeling of nutrient-related indicators, and of course, a focus on harmful algal blooms. decreasing carbon emissions and subsidence and increasing carbon sequestration on natural agricultural lands is an area of ongoing focus that you'll hear more about from Campbell Ingram on the panel. Efforts to reduce the impact of invasive species through prevention, early detection, response, eradication, control is a focus area that spans the entire estuary. And there are a suite of actions focused on protecting and restoring a variety of habitats throughout the estuary. And managing sediment and soil on a regional scale and advancing beneficial reuse to enhance estuary habitats and shoreline flood protection efforts is a critical focus area and one that you'll be hearing about more from Letitia Vernier. And the Delta Stewardship Council specifically is listed as a lead or collaborating partner on over 30 tasks within the blueprint, spanning this suite of topic areas. And Laurel Larson will be speaking more about our coordination efforts as we strive to continue to align our plans, our documents, and our programs in an effort to connect the Bay and the Delta as one estuary. So with that, I really look forward to hearing from all the panelists, and I thank you again for your time this afternoon. Back to you, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks, Caitlin. We'll have time for questions afterward, but if there's a burning question, one that just you can't help but pop out of your mouth, raise your hand, speak up, yell, wave, whatever you want to do. But we definitely will have time afterward. Okay. With that being said, Amanda, where do we go? Because I have forgotten my list over. It's on the dining room table, so I have to grab it. So I apologize.
I think we are moving first to Laurel. Correct.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, so Caitlin's presentation was a nice segue into mine. I've been asked to speak about the ways in which the Delta Science Program and the Delta Stewardship Council have contributed to this co-review of the estuary blueprint and coordination in terms of communication. One of the things that Caitlin mentioned is that integration is a big theme of this estuary blueprint. And conveniently, we are about to come out with our final release of the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda, which is also packaged under the theme of integration. When we talk about integration, we're talking about geographic integration. That's critical, the need to think about our estuary as a system beyond the boundaries of the legal delta. So looking to the watershed, looking down to the lower estuary. We're talking about integration from a disciplinary perspective. I think it's natural that our community is at the point where we are trying to grapple with understanding how perturbations like rapid climate change are going to be affecting the response of our system as a whole. We've spent decades trying to understand individual components of that system. And what's really critical now is to really see the big picture, how all of these components fit together to process that climate change that it's experiencing at such a rapid pace. Integration also refers to integration of the tools that we're using to project what the future is going to be and to look at the combination of data and models, as well as information about regulatory constraints and needs of people within the system. Integration also refers to coordination across institutions. So it was very natural for us at the point of developing the Science Action Agenda to look at the estuary blueprint and, you know, figure out where there was commonality between these two documents, where maybe things we were thinking about in the Delta needed to appear in that estuary blueprint, and then also to help with that integration across institutions, who might be natural leads for actions within the estuary blueprint. So I'm going to switch over to sharing slides. My slides are not as pretty as Caitlin's are, but I have prepared some tables that show some of the ways in which there is specific overlap with actions in the blueprint. Let me just go ahead and put this into presenting mode. So hopefully you could see the screen now. These slides are wordy. I'm not going to go through everything, but one of the things that we did do is we went through each of the blueprint actions, and I'm just referring to them by their shorthand here, and identified actions within the 2022 to 2026 science action agenda or management needs within the science action agenda that were directly aligned with those actions in the estuary blueprint. And then we also identified nexuses with other initiatives that the council is undertaking. And so I've highlighted a few just to show the diversity of the types of activities for which there is substantial overlap across this Bay Delta boundary. And so the climate resilience is something that's being directly addressed through the Delta Adapts Initiative as one example. Caitlin mentioned that equity is a big focus of the estuary blueprint. And likewise, it's become a big focus for us in the Delta with the launch of the Environmental Justice White Paper and the assembly of an environmental justice expert panel for the Delta and Sassoon Marsh. Just another example here is that the draft PEIR for the new amendment, the Chapter 4 amendment to the Delta Plan, speaks directly to some of the adaptation planning that's present in the estuary blueprint. And I'll just scroll through these. I don't have much time on this panel today, but there were occasions where the action in the blueprint highlighted topics that should be more of a priority for us in the Delta. And one is this focus on sediment, which Letitia is going to speak about in a little bit. But there was a great idea that Caitlin had that made it into the estuary blueprint about expanding this sediment survival analysis that's been done for wetlands in the Bay to the Delta, which is particularly important given that we have so many thousands of acres of wetland restoration targets in the Delta. What sediment supply is needed in order to ensure the persistence of those targets? So that's an important priority that was really highlighted. We also helped connect the SFEP to scientists who are leading Delta Science Program funded work on greenhouse gas budgets for wetlands as one example, and detrital contributions to food webs. And not to belabor this too long, but here are a few of the other nexuses. There were certain actions that were quite relevant to past relevant work that the science program has engaged in. Those are highlighted in green, or ongoing work from other agencies, such as the State Water Resources Control Board, that we've been engaged with as well. So another opportunity that was highlighted was the opportunity to seek integration across the meetings that we have, which have historically been focused on the lower estuary, that's the State of the Estuary meeting, and then the Delta, which is the Bay Delta Science Conferences. And so we have ongoing conversations on how we might better integrate those two meetings. So I think I will end it there because I'm at the end of my time, but I'm happy to provide these tables if they're of interest.
Thanks, Laurel. Sorry about that. Thanks, Laurel. Appreciate it. It's pretty clear that we have people thinking about this, and we can at least draw lines between that which happens here and that which happens there. And one of the newest people to the administration who is drawing an awful lot of lines between and among things is Moy. So, Moy, you are on top.
Thank you, Larry. Buenas tardes a todos los presentes. Estoy agradecido por la invitación que me han otorgado el día de hoy. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very thankful to the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee for this invitation. My name is Moises Moneda Rivera, and I humbly serve as the Assistant Secretary for Equity and Environmental Justice at the Natural Resources Agency. This work is extremely critical, and I'm glad to be in community with you all today. I want to start today with an anecdote from my previous role within state government. I had attended the 2018 Tribal Water Summit, where the Delta was brought up in conversation, and how the Delta is not only of cultural and traditional significance to tribal nations in and around the Delta, but to the nations who are connected to the Delta by the rivers and other water bodies, a part of its ecosystem. I mentioned this because months later, I was advising my colleagues who were working on a project whose boundaries touched on the Delta. They wanted to confirm with me if it was sufficient to only notify the tribal nations within the rectangle they had carved out of the map. I could not help to think about the northern tribal nations and the relationship to the Bay Delta, especially in relation to the salmon, whom for many are considered the relatives. So being asked to confirm a few number of tribal nations in their rectangle appeared a bit comical and out of touch. I reached out to the Native American Heritage Commission, as one would do for a project like this. And to my colleague's surprise, they could not fathom how many tribes had interest in the Bay Delta and felt overwhelmed with the amount of notifications that had to take place for their project. I assured them that our office would be there to support them along the way, and being intentional in their efforts since the get-go would be a great first step. I shared with my colleagues resources and information as to why the Native American Heritage Commission had given them such a broad list, took the time to educate as to how printed project scope maps, while static, with detailed lines and boundaries, are actually fluid, like the water that connects them. My former director shares a story about the state trying to do the right thing with the Hmong speaking community for a drinking water project and hired interpreters and translated the meeting documents. And when the meeting day comes, the Hmong community does not show up. No one noticed that the meeting invitations were only in English and did not mention there would be interpretation in Hmong or that the materials had been translated. Alternatively, in 2019, the California Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Justice Enforcement Task Force, comprised of enforcement staff from Cal EPA and each of its 5 regulatory boards and departments, as well as federal and local partner agencies, carried out an environmental justice initiative in Stockton. The initiative focused on strategies to address some of the community's major environmental concerns as identified by residents, city officials, and community partners. Working with local enforcement agencies, the task force conducted over 200 inspections in facilities and 80 heavy duty trucks looking for violations. And when appropriate, issuing citations where violations were found. The task force was also identified gaps in local regulatory enforcement programs and worked with local regulatory agencies to address them. I'm starting with these anecdotes because they exemplify how there are areas within government that showcase how we must improve, and others to how, when done right, can serve as models for our colleagues to follow. While these are just a few examples, they're not unique, and we as government have a responsibility to acknowledge and identify ways to improve and turn best practices into standard practices. It helps to talk about them in a forum like this. A number of entities that make up the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee have taken strides in the past years to incorporate racial equity and diversity and inclusion initiatives into their work. This, of course, is part of a broader California Olive Government approach to acknowledge historic wrongs and combat structural racism and bias in California's institutions. At our agency, we have identified and prioritized several areas in which to advance this meaningful work. I will highlight a few today. A key priority area is building our partnerships with California Native American tribes, an effort that my colleague Geneva E.B. Thompson, our Assistant Secretary for Tribal Affairs, is leading. California tribes have stewarded California's natural environment since time immemorial. A couple of weeks ago, I was with her in the Coachella Valley, where thanks to her, our agency attended an intergovernmental roundtable whose focus was building state tribal partnerships and identify areas of collaboration. Another great example of government entities working collectively, as we are here today. Geneva also shared with me that as part of her work, a new Delta Tribal Affairs Working Group has been established to improve coordination within state government. It is comprised of tribal affairs staff from CNRA departments that have projects that are in, near, and around the Delta. If you want to learn more, I encourage you to reach out to my colleague, Geneva. Another key priority is improving on how we engage with California's historically and currently underserved populations. Working collaboratively with community partners to identify how our projects and funding resonate with their respective communities, especially if there are language needs. For a long time, California investments, including those for vital community infrastructure like parks and the outdoors were, and in many regards still are, vastly unequal, as mentioned by previous speakers. We're working to change this narrative. And while we do this, communities' voices must be centered. It is important to know who lives in the Delta, who is impacted by the decisions that take place in and around the Delta. Earlier this month, our agency leadership visited the Delta and not only visited project sites that aim to conserve land to protect biodiversity, whose adjacent community school children are learning about and participating as part of the project. We also visited Isleton and Locke and learned about the vast contributions the Chinese community have made in the Delta, and whose experience in the Delta has not always been pleasant at the hands of xenophobic and racist laws and policies. As we drove through the Delta, I was also reminded of the contributions the Filipino community have made and their vast presence in Stockton, and how during World War II, the Delta region became an epicenter for the Bracero program that was initially driven by the demand of agricultural laborers to harvest sugar beets and orchard crops in the region. I was also reminded of the delicious food and the languages spoken, and how the threats of climate change will impact the peoples and cultures that live in the area. In some areas, due to redlining, more than others. Throughout history, the Delta has been a crossroads and a place of environmental change and agricultural fortune, as well as a destination for newcomers. The history we inherit, we cannot change, though we can learn from it and work together to enact change. Incorporating an early and often government-to-government consultation process is necessary. Identifying how you can collaborate with your colleagues to address meeting fatigue that advocates have brought up, following up with your colleagues with questions you have received from your respective constituents, working closely with communities to know when and where is best to host a meeting, to meet communities where they are at, not where it is feasible for us. Ensuring that language is not a barrier to participation in our public process, whether it's providing information in plain language or in a language other than English. Finding ways to make our information more accessible. Working closely with community partners and members is key. We at CNRA are aligning our efforts to do this more efficiently. We're working on identifying best practices and finding ways to make them standard practices. Another key priority is improving our hiring, our recruitment, and retention strategies. We do this by revisiting and improving our programs, policies, and procedures. Having a workforce that reflects the California of today, especially one that reflects the Delta, enhances our ability to engage with all Californians and will help make our agency and its entities employers of choice. Seeing California's demographics reflected in staff is a first step towards breaking down the cultural barriers that alienate and endanger underserved populations in parks and other natural areas. We all have an instrumental role to play in advancing racial equity as we strengthen our work to protect our natural resources. Excitingly and currently, as Laurel mentioned, the Delta Stewardship Council is working to identify opportunities for greater integration of social sciences within the council's work and the Delta more broadly. She mentioned one of the initiatives, which is focused on environmental justice, and where they are preparing an issue paper to investigate the need for additional strategies or responses to address environmental justice within the Delta plan, right? So, and one of the DPIIC's restoration subcommittee's goals is to provide forums for meaningful community participation in the Delta restoration efforts. Being intentional and inclusive is important. There's so much more work ahead of us, and I'm delighted that the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee and their independent members are actively finding ways to align their efforts into how they engage. While state agencies have responsibility to address this work, it takes all of us to work collectively on these matters. Remember this, let's turn best practices into standard practices. Thank you.
Thanks, Moy. So now I want to go to Campbell, who on a daily basis is dealing with issues that come from east, west, north, and south, and has demonstrated the ability to make sure that he is thinking across the estuary. Campbell, where are you? There you are.
I'm here. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'll just quickly share that there's been a car horn continuously blowing for about 15 minutes outside my window, and it just stopped. So I'm relieved. I'm excited to be here to drill down a little bit and talk specifically about the Action 7 of the Estuary Blueprint, which is carbon management, an issue that's near and dear to my heart. The objective is to decrease carbon emissions of subsidence in the Delta and increase carbon sequestration on natural and agricultural lands. And it recognizes the importance of wetlands and carbon management across the Bay Delta system. The first task identifies a 20,000 acre target for the deeply subsided areas of the Delta. And most DPIC members will know that I've spoken with you on several occasions about this 200,000 acre deep hole that we have out in the Delta that was all once rich organic peat soil that has volatilized carbon directly into the atmosphere over the last 150 years, continues to do so at astounding rates. And of course, that results in the subsidence that we see out there in the Delta, and it threatens the state and federal water projects, as well as the Delta communities and all the Delta agriculture. So it's great to see this, this objective that it's an ambitious but achievable 20,000 acre target over the next 5 years to do conversions. And I'll talk a little bit more about the types of conversions here in a second. Action 7 also focuses on applied research to improve our understanding of wetland carbon flux from different kinds of wetlands and ag lands. So this would include the managed wetlands in the Delta, tidal freshwater wetlands in the Delta, as well as brackish wetlands in the Sassoon Marsh and coastal wetlands throughout the estuary and the bay system. It also increases or recognizes the need to increase the economic impact of carbon markets and promote carbon revenue to support wetland restoration. Also talked to DPIC in the past about the approved American Carbon Registry Protocol that was developed for coastal and deltaic wetlands. So this allows landowners to essentially re-wet lands. So coastal areas that were historic wetlands and or in the Delta convert to rice cultivation or managed wetlands. And the protocol allows to calculate the baseline and the avoided emissions and certify those emission reduction tons and then take them to market to realize a carbon revenue stream. I've also shared that in the past that we have actually completed the first certification of wetland carbon credits anywhere, and that we have several pilot projects that are in development. So this is an area where the Delta is really leading. There's been a lot of work in this space and a lot happening continuously, and it can inform efforts further down in the estuary as we move forward. I also really want to highlight briefly an emerging climate and carbon management issue that's really going to require us to work across the Bay Delta Estuary. Carbon capture storage has been really gaining traction in the Delta. Carbon capture storage is where we capture carbon emissions from industrial processes, most commonly from cement production or power generation and petrochemical refining. And there are even opportunities just to capture carbon from the ambient air. And then that carbon is compressed, transported, and then stored deep in the Earth's surface. So there's emerging recognition that if we're going to meet our climate goals, we're going to have to employ carbon capture technology. And the Delta has been identified as one of two locations in the Western United States where carbon can be safely stored in geologic confining layers 8 to 10,000 feet below the surface. So we have some of the largest sources of carbon emissions in the East Bay, industrial sources such as the refineries and power production facilities. And then we have a readily available, very large source or pore space in the Delta. And ultimately, if we're going to try to employ this, we're going to have to sort out how we capture at the source, transport, compress, and inject and store if we're going to be successful. So this issue has generated a tremendous amount of interest in the Delta. There are many companies out there on the landscape looking to access this pore space. Think about how they can put their carbon deep below the Delta. And it's a relatively new technology, though it has been used effectively in several places globally. There are concerns about this technology, particularly from the environmental justice and environmental advocacy communities. So it's really going to be crucial that we work together to ensure awareness and transparency and involvement of the potentially impacted communities. And we navigate this issue that will really require us to work very effectively across all the scientific issues, the social environmental justice issues, and then the economic issues for carbon capture storage. So just wrapping up, I'm excited about the recognition of carbon management throughout the estuary and continued working across the Bay Delta system. And also just want to mention that both the Delta Conservancy and the Delta Stewardship Council are members of the Estuary Partnership Implementation Committee. So that's another way that there's really continuous engagement and cross-pollinization across the two systems. So thank you for the opportunity and look forward to any questions.
Thanks, Campbell. The two words you didn't mention that figure prominently in that are supply and demand, because we will definitely have supply. There's definitely demand. And that's why I want to now go to Letitia Grenier, because she is the doyen of supply and demand when it comes to sediment. So off to you.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me here to talk about this important issue. And I'm going to start by telling you a little about a project we've done for the Bay called Sediment for Survival, which looks at sediment supply and demand. And then I will broaden out to talk about at the end about how we could be thinking about cross-pollination, like Campbell was talking about, between the Bay and the Delta when we're thinking about sediment issues. And just to be clear, sediment matters because it's about resilience. It's about resilience of the land form. It's about whether or not things that should flood, flood, and things that don't flood, don't flood. Whether or not we're actually capturing carbon where we want to in our marshes, protecting our shorelines, providing people places to recreate, providing a habitat for endangered species, processing nutrients. The marshes that I'm going to talk about are incredibly valuable, consistently valued as some of the most important ecosystems on Earth for people. So we often think of them as valuable for nature and wildlife, which they are, but also for people. So we're very aligned in this sense. The report that we did for the Bay was called Sediment for Survival, and we were thinking about how can we get enough sediment to keep these critical wetlands resilient, providing the functions that we are interested in them giving to us for many decades to come, despite sea level rise. And it was funded by an EPA grant. It's a very collaborative project. Next slide. And I'll just show you here just some of the committees that were involved, and I won't go through the details, but we really work on having the regional community involved. This is Bay focused, not Delta in this case, so that we can bring people along in the understanding of what are the technical issues that we're facing when we're thinking about these really big investments we're making in our coastal wetlands. For example, our Restoration Authority, which is handing out $500 million over the course of 20 years to work on keeping these marshes resilient and restore them. Next slide. So put very simply, this report asked, how much sediment do we need to keep our marshes and mudflats? So these are the intertidal dominant habitats that we have in the lower estuary. How much sediment do we need to keep them around as sea level rises? And I'll tell you about the scenarios in a minute. How much sediment is available? And what's the difference between the two? We knew there was a big deficit. And so we ask, how can we get more? Next slide. And I'm going to give a super brief primer on how these ecosystems work with relationship to sediment, since not everybody at this meeting sits and thinks about this all day like I often do. So you've got the tide coming in and out. These are intertidal habitats. They're between high and low tide. So here we're looking at, this is North San Francisco Bay. This is near China Camp State Park here on the left. And the squiggly lines are these channels that bring tidal waters in and out of the tidal marsh, which is this reddish brownish area. The kind of grayish part in the lower right is the mud flat. And if you imagine this, the tidal waters come in, they have a lot of sediments, very murky. They come up and they stop at high tide. And suddenly the velocity of the water is zero. All the sediment falls out and lands on the marsh. And that's how they build themselves up vertically over time. And then the tide goes out again. The tide is much clearer. You can see through it on the way out. It's muddy on the way in. So that's how these marshes build themselves up over time. And they will actually go upward and move inland. So they're very resilient and adaptive on their own. But we tend to mess that up by taking away their sediment or making sea level rise too high or putting a levee in back of them. But they have a very natural ability to adapt with climate change if we can think about how to take advantage of that rather than working against it. Next slide. So I don't want to go into the details of all the scenarios we looked at, but this was a technical analysis looking forward in time to say, will we have enough sediment to keep these important landforms and habitats providing the functions we want? So what I'm going to talk about from here on out is our desired future restoration scenario. This is what the community of the Bay Area had decided on through these two big projects called the Baylands Goals, the Baylands Ecosystem Habitat Goals, and then the science update to that. And that actually has a goal of 100,000 acres. We don't know where those 100,000 acres would come from. We've only got about 72,000 of them laid out on the landscape. So we analyzed those 72,000 acres for Sassoon, San Pablo, and San Francisco Bays. We looked at sea level rise projections going out to 2100, which is 6.9 feet across that full amount of time, which is a mid to high estimate, although sadly the estimates keep getting higher. And then we looked at two future scenarios of climate, slightly wetter, slightly drier, both pretty likely to try to bookend the potential futures. Next slide. And what we found out was we need a lot of sediment and we don't have it. So the amount of sediment that we need to do what I just said, keep those 72,000 acres of current marshes and mudflats, plus what we have already purchased and planned to restore to tidal marsh, to keep them until 2100 under about 7 feet of sea level rise, is 450 million cubic yards, which is it's basically an astronomical amount. I think it's if you put dump trucks nose to tail around the equator, they would circle the Earth 10 times. It's a lot of sediment. It's a really big estuary. Next slide. And we have some big holes we've created. So then we said, well, how much are we going to get if we do business as usual? And the answer is about 30%. So we have a 70% gap or deficit in the amount of sediment that we need. So currently we have sediment that is naturally delivered by rivers and tides. And then we dredge sediment and we place that dredge sediment in areas that have subsided, just like they've subsided in the Delta, to bring them up to the right elevation before we breach, so that we can restore a tidal marsh at the right elevation in that location. Next slide. We do actually have enough sediment to make up that enormous deficit, but we have to engage in a really different way of managing and thinking about the landscape. What we need to do is add additional dredged sediment to start nourishing our existing marshes, as well as filling up those holes. This is something we haven't done yet. We don't know how to get it permitted. Agencies are working on it, but we're going to have to actively supplement the sediment supply to our marshes and mudflats. Then we need to think about that's not enough. So in addition to that, we need to think about the excavated dirt. This is all the development that happens up in the watershed. Google's digging out a basement to make a giant building. That's a lot of dirt. It gets trucked to landfills right now for the most part, and that's a waste of that material. And we really want to think about reusing that material for the public good in our coastal wetland spaces. We don't have strong regulation or monitoring or even tracking of the numbers on this. So this is a best guess given what's out there, but there's a lot to be done in terms of taking advantage of that dirt that's really going to waste in landfills right now. And then finally, we need to manage our watersheds differently. There's a lot of sediment trapped up in reservoirs and elsewhere in the watershed. And if we managed our watersheds differently, we could use water to push sediment downhill out to the bay, which is how it originally worked via natural processes before we changed them with our reservoirs and our water management. So I will give you a little bit more information about that. But the good news is we are not the Netherlands. We have lots of options. We have elevation, we have sediments, but we have to change our practices. And that is the bad news, because that's really hard for us to do. Next slide. So when we think about what are the things we need to change, we need to think about dredge sediment as one leg of our three-legged stool strategy. We need to think about migration space. And that's where you don't have to move sediment around at all. You let the marsh migrate itself inward, which it will inland, which it will naturally do, but you have to remove levees and allow it the space to do that. So anywhere where we have a natural open space right behind a marsh, we would like to keep that elevation and allow the marsh just to roll over that space. And then we don't have to move sediment around and do these very expensive things that we have to do to keep these marshes going. And then finally, watershed management. And that's the really complicated one that's so hard for us to imagine with our complicated water management that we already have. Next slide. And I will just say really briefly, we can go into this in much more detail in another conversation if anyone's interested, but there's a lot of things we can do. The watershed is a system. We've taken it apart and broken it down. And, you know, over here, I'm thinking about water supply. Over here, I'm thinking about water quality. Oh, but down here, suddenly it's flooding. Oh, no, I don't want it to flood down here. That's because we didn't think about the watershed as a system. And if we can start thinking at that system level of full watershed and put the pieces back together, we have the science to do that now. We can restore and manage in a way that creates more benefits than what we have now, but it does require a lot more coordination and change. And we're just not set up for that with the kind of separate entities and overlapping jurisdictions and different missions that we've got out there right now. It's really challenging. Next slide. One thing that is a really good idea is to think about managing our flows differently. And this is really an idea coming out of the Sierras and the Delta. We haven't started employing this in the Bay yet. We need to be employing this in our local watersheds in the Bay, probably lots of places. So this idea of functional flows, as most of you know, was put into place for native fish to try to create, despite the fact that we're taking a lot of the water out of our rivers, create the signals that our native fish need to do well and the actual habitat, physical habitat conditions they need to do well. But this is also really good for sediment. That long tail of the red that you see going out through June, if we can let that be longer and higher, it's going to push those fine sediments out of the gravels where the salmon need to spawn. So that's important for them, but it also pushes those fines, those really fine clays, out into the bays and the estuary where we really need them to build up our marshes. So it's a win-win, but it's hard for us to manage water that way. But this is one of the ways that we can keep our rivers healthy and keep our estuary healthy. So this is an example in terms of cross-pollination that we need to bring from the Delta and start employing in other places, even though the political lever for salmon is not quite, for salmon and other fish, is not as big in other places. We still need to be doing this for other multiple benefits. Next slide. And so as we think about looking across the estuary, what are the things that we could do in either half? How could we learn from each other better if we were more coordinated? From the Delta, we could use this idea of functional flows in the Bay, like I was just talking about. We also really need to think about peat farming. So this is where in the Delta, the USGS and others have been using marshes to actually build elevation and sequester carbon. And Campbell has talked about this a lot. We probably have to start doing this in the Bay. We're putting a lot of effort into building these low slope levees, but we still have lots of subsided areas. We have wastewater treatment plants all around the Bay. We could take that fresh water and start to do some peat farming in the Bay. And this is an idea that hasn't caught on yet, but we probably need to start looking into these more innovative techniques, not as innovative in the Delta, but would be very innovative in the Bay. Looking from the other direction, if we looked from what the Delta could learn from the Bay, doing some kind of sediment supply and demand analysis, like I just showed you, it would build on Delta and apps and take that to a new level and really help start thinking about what's realistic in terms of tidal marsh and where can we go with restoration? How long will these restorations last after we've put millions of dollars into them? How can we make them last into perpetuity so we can have the benefits that they offer? And then finally, migration space. And again, that's the space where a marsh will naturally move inland if we allow it. The Delta is full of migration space and it's on private land. So it's a big political issue that's very difficult to talk about. But landform wise, it's a huge opportunity. We could have a lot more resilience in the Delta, but I think of our marshes and these other valuable habitats, I think it's what we all know is that elevation is everything in the Delta. So how can we ensure that restoration happens at a variety of elevations and not just in the wildly subsided areas that are no longer valuable for agriculture? So I think there's a lot to think about here. Sediment is kind of the lowest common denominator on top of which all the other processes start to build themselves up. Next slide. I'll just point out one other key feature, and I often try to get people in the Bay to care about what's happening in the Delta. I'm thinking of Larry's introduction. I don't know if people are laugh at the Delta. I think they just don't think about it. Sometimes people don't even realize it's there when they're living in the Bay. But one of the things we really rely on the Delta for is our inorganic sediment supply. If you look at this map, it's showing where our sediment comes from in the Bay. And 1.3 million tons comes from our local watersheds. 0.7 million tons comes from the Delta. One third of the sediment we're getting right now comes from the Delta. If the Delta does all the restoration that is planned, that number is going to go way down. Or if we just start to, or if we have something catastrophic and these very subsided areas are opened up to the tide, remember all that water is going to come in, high tide is going to stop, and all the sediment is going to fall down into those deep areas. So these are really important issues to coordinate on. We have hundreds of millions of dollars going into investments here, and we need to have that long-term visioning and long-term planning to know what's going to happen with those investments. And I think stronger cross-pollination across the Bay Delta would be helpful. Next slide. And that's what I really wanted to advocate for. If you want to understand what's going to happen with sediment with landform resilience, with whether or not you're going to get those functions delivered to people, such as nutrient processing that makes us all pay less money on our sewage treatment bills. Honestly, these habitats are doing that for us right now, but we don't realize it. Then we need a vision that tells us how many acres and where, so that we can start to plan on how to keep them resilient with sediment, be it inorganic like clay or be it organic like peat farming. Thank you so much for listening. Next slide. I really appreciate having this topic be brought up to you all.
Thank you, Letitia. We really appreciate it. Amanda, I don't know what our timing is for questions. What do you think?
We are getting close to being out of time.
That's what I thought.
Maybe check if there are any burning questions.
Speak up now or forever hold your peace for the next hour and a quarter until after the program when you can email everybody. Oh, Virginia had her hand up. There we go.
Thank you, Larry. It wasn't so much a question, more a comment specifically for Moises. And may I just say your full name, Moises Moreno Rivera. Truly appreciated your comments with regard to insightful strategies and best practices for equity, inclusion, and diversity needs in obviously meeting the demands of communities that live adjacent to the Delta. I was intrigued by your comments and really impressed by your passion, if you will, on the subject matter. And I think it's time to really rally the troops. And I just loved how you premised that. I work on some projects throughout the state, and it just seems that sometimes people are just checking the box. You know, we met the minimum requirements as stated by both the federal or state government. And so it really is going to take more of an insightful approach, much like you are proposing, strategies and best practices that really get to the core of meeting members of the community that have never really been approached. And so it's more than just checking the box. It's more than just saying we did it. We did our very best to identify, you know, those communities that have never been approached, but it's really taking on the task in a much more meaningful way to really engage those community members that we say have not been invited to the table. So more than anything, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you for listening and thank you for reacting. I want to spend a minute and riff just a minute on what I thought about during the presentation, then I'm going to hand it off to Caitlin and she can sum it up and we can end. I want to say one thing, which is that when we started this thinking about this, one thing that we all agreed upon was that this discussion was not meant in any way to admonish anybody for not doing something. Instead, the real purpose is to provide examples of how people can do something. And that is incredibly important because as Moy and Letitia, as everybody basically pointed out, what's really needed to make sure that we have intra-estuary collaboration and partnership, that is across the estuary, from literally from the Golden Gate all the way up, is really a cultural change. It's a change that we need to start thinking externally as much as we're thinking internally within our government agencies. And that means we're going to end up having governance changes. And nothing's harder for a government to do than to change its processes. I mean, it's just miserable. We all know that. We've all tried to do it, and we've had various levels of success. But as we move into a greater age of uncertainty, especially the regulatory agencies are going to have to figure out how to regulate in an age of uncertainty. And that's really hard to do. And the more we can do across the Delta, with planning and with discussing and making sure that what we do over here is in collaboration with the folks over there, and we actually can do it in an integrated fashion, then that's when the people of California, the environment of California, and really the whole social structure and environmental structure of California will benefit. So with that, I'm going to throw it over to Caitlin to finish it off.
Thanks, Larry. That was a great ending. I don't know what I can possibly add to that, but just a quick last thought, I suppose. You know, usually when I give these blueprint presentations to various bodies, I have some sort of slide about why on earth should you care about the blueprint? You know, yet another planning document. It's not even regulatory. And two reasons I usually say, and that's true for any of these kinds of processes, is that the process itself of updating something like the blueprint is so valuable in bringing people together to try to agree on these key priorities like we've done today, to identify those areas where we can really amplify each other's messages, to increase efficiencies and success, and also identifying the gaps as we've done today, where we need more science, where we aren't as collaborative as we could be, you know, what voices are not at the table. And then secondly, the blueprint is one of those vehicles, as are many of these other documents and processes that we have to elevate our high priority actions for support and funding. We're facing an influx of state and federal funding to this region for restoration, climate resilience and adaptation, for increasing the capacity of frontline indigenous communities. And the more that we can speak to funding needs in one voice, the more we can present collaborative integrated funding proposals, the more successful we will be in accessing these funds. And I want to acknowledge that that's really hard. Coordinating our messaging and collaborating and funding proposals across the entire estuary is really difficult and something we aren't that good at yet. But entities such as the DPIC and forums like this one are really a great opportunity to make those connections to advance integrated collaborative projects for funding. So it's been a pleasure, and I thank the panelists so much and thank the DPIC for listening today. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, I would just express once again our thanks to you, Larry, and to all our panelists, to Caitlin, Laurel, Moy, Campbell, and Letitia. I think you came together on a panel that was both thoughtful in its comments and presentations, but very thought-provoking and hopefully motivational, many different perspectives. And I think you pointed out the number of the challenges, and we're in the midst of working to address those, but the opportunities that avail themselves as well. I think, you know, to the point of collaboration and coordination, integration, change, many, many other describers of I think things that were covered in the presentation. But I for one come away being hopeful for, you know, what the future will bring, and it'll obviously be influenced by folks that spoke on the panel, but certainly by all of us in our respective roles and the entities we represent. So again, thank you so much, Larry, for moderating the panel. Thank you to all of our panelists, and I guess we can do kind of a silent applause for all of you, but again, please hear us in that regard, and thank you for being with us today, and we look forward to continued collaboration and coordination through the DPIC and other avenues that are present and that have yet to even be thought of, I imagine. So, Amanda, did you want to say anything in conclusion?
No, I think just see if potentially there's any public comment out there.
Okay, so one more time, and thank you, Virginia, for your comments as well, my colleague on the council and our vice chair of the Delta Stewardship Council. Anyone else? Any public comments? Do we have any blue cards, Brandon and Bob?
No, sir. There are no public comments.
Okay. Let me just ask too, before we move to the next part of our agenda, are copies of the presentations available on the website, Amanda, the PowerPoints, or Larry?
They are not currently available, but if someone wants to email me, I'm happy to send them copies of the presentations.
Okay. Some of those I think would be good for you know, referencing as people would, you know, I think reflect on what was presented here today. So again, thank you very much. Really appreciate it, Larry and Caitlin and all the rest of the panelists. So, all right. Well, as we move to our agenda, I know we've still got a couple of other important items for today. And so as we move down, then we have the Delta Restoration and DPIC Restoration Subcommittee, which again, I want to credit my our past chair, but certainly former colleague on the Delta Stewardship Council and others who have been real leaders. And again, thank you, Amanda, for helping to shepherd this as we've gone along. And so what I'll do, and I think this will require some consensus action at the conclusion, but as we go into it, we're gonna hear from one of our immediate past presenters, Campbell Ingram, as well as Jeff Henderson. And they're going to introduce the the topic. And again, I want to introduce both of them and let them carry the presentation. And this comes off some direction was given at the October 2021 DPIC meeting. So, Amanda, anything else you need to lead in with?
No, that sounds great. Thank you.
Very good. Okay, so we'll go to our Campbell and to Jeff. Take it over.
Great, thanks. Good to talk to you again. Amanda, are you going to share the slides? Good. Okay. Jeff and I would like to present draft Restoration Subcommittee vision and goals in the hope that the DPIC will endorse the vision and goals today. Just a little bit of background. At the October 18th, 2021 DPIC meeting, we introduced you to the expectation that we would be establishing a Restoration Subcommittee of DPIC. And we talked about the objectives, the overall structure, and what we hoped it would accomplish. And at that meeting, DPIC endorsed the establishment of the Restoration Subcommittee. We brought the Restoration Subcommittee together for the first time in January of this year. And at that first meeting, we discussed the background and purpose of the subcommittee. We reviewed the history of restoration of the Delta, which was really great for all of us to really take a comprehensive overview of what we've achieved in the Delta and what things are currently planned and how we will continue to do planning in the Delta. And then we began to discuss a vision and focus for the group. And at that meeting, we established a subgroup to develop the vision and goal statement. And then at a March 13th meeting, that group brought back the draft vision and goals that we're going to discuss today. I also, at that March 13th meeting, we started to plan our first Delta Restoration Forum. And if you recall from the October meeting, the intent there is to at least semi-annually create a forum where we welcome the Delta community in and have a more comprehensive conversation about what are the restoration targets, what's happening in the system currently, and provide an opportunity to get more feedback and discussion with the community about restoration and what's happening in the system. So we're hoping to have that first forum likely in June. But today, again, what we're hoping is that the subcommittee or the DPIC will endorse the subcommittee's vision and goals. So Jeff and I are just gonna walk you through. So the first slide is the vision statement. And basically, I'm just going to read it. It says the DPIC Restoration Subcommittee envisions a Delta ecosystem that supports the mosaic of natural and human communities, is resilient to stressors, adapts to change, and is accessible for recreation. We came up with four goals under that vision statement. And I'm just going to quickly read these, and then Jeff's going to go a little more detail about the objectives under each goal. So goal one is to increase the interagency collaboration to streamline restoration implementation. Goal two is to identify opportunities in restoration planning and long-term management. Goal three is to increase transparency and coordination around existing, new, and needed restoration funding. And goal four is to provide forums for meaningful community participation in Delta restoration efforts. That's the high-level vision and goal statements, and I'll turn it over to Jeff now to walk us through in a little more detail.
Thanks, Campbell. Next slide, please. So as Campbell mentioned, each of these goals is supported by a number of objectives that the subcommittee considered and discussed and ultimately proposed. These objectives are leading us, just kind of foreshadow where we're headed, these objectives in turn will be leading us to a work plan that the subcommittee will be embarking on to help promote these goals and objectives. So under the first goal to increase interagency collaboration, our objectives include identifying regulatory challenges to restoration and potential solutions, especially synergies with the cutting the green tape efforts, identifying efficiencies and areas for improved collaboration and in terms of long-term management of restoration lands, really building on experiences that have already come to pass in terms of inviting groups that have been established already to overcome implementation challenges to our meetings and forums to learn about their approaches to reducing barriers. Identifying and pursuing options to sustain and support the restoration committee long-term, and developing the work plan that I mentioned previously based on these approved goals and objectives, including a structure and process for conduct of the subcommittee. Next slide, please. So the second goal was to identify opportunities in restoration planning and long-term management. Here, we're exploring the current uses and future development needs to promote the Delta Landscape Scenario Planning Tool that I believe we've discussed at DPIC in prior meetings, and other modeling tools that can help to support the prediction of restoration outcomes, particularly at a large landscape-wide scale. Also to support this goal, we'll be identifying mechanisms to evaluate the effectiveness of restoration projects and the opportunities to better implement long-term adaptive management, monitoring, and synthesis such that we're learning from one project to the next and employing those lessons to engender better restoration outcomes. And third, to pursue opportunities for coordination with the Delta Science Program and the Delta Independent Science Board, recognizing that the expertise of both of those programs and organizations will benefit the outcomes that we're seeking under these goals and objectives. Next slide, please. The third goal Campbell mentioned was to increase transparency and coordination around existing new and needed restoration funding. And the objectives for this goal include synthesizing and sharing what we know about existing and new funding programs to help understand what's out there in terms of the current restoration funding landscape. Secondly, to identify where the bottlenecks are institutionally with regard to converting available funds into on-the-ground restoration projects in terms of staff capacity and in terms of potentially restrictive bond language, helping to identify solutions to reduce multiple bottlenecks, but particularly these three specific ones. And then if needed, calling on members of the subcommittee and potentially the full DPIC to help advocate for adequate funding to meet the ecosystem goals and objectives that are set forth. Next slide, please. And then the fourth and final goal is to provide forums for meaningful community participation in Delta restoration efforts. I believe Campbell indicated that we are actively working on our first community forum that'll be coming up this summer to hold these public forums to welcome and encourage public participation in the restoration process. Convening that forum at least twice a year to discuss the current restoration efforts that are underway within the Delta and hear about community concerns about those projects, preferably at a very early design stage. And then third, to develop a robust outreach and engagement program that specifically involves local landowners and agencies, environmental justice organizations, tribes, and Delta community members. So that provides a little bit more detail behind each of those proposed goals. Again, we'll be using this information to develop a work plan for the committee and look forward to bringing future updates to the DPIC as a full committee. And I believe Supervisor Natoli, that concludes our presentation and would look to the DPIC to potentially endorse these goals and recommendations.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Campbell, for the presentations. Let me go to committee members here first and see if there are any questions regarding the vision and the priorities and the summaries are outlined by both Campbell and Jeff. We are seeking consensus around this today so that then the DPIC will have this, assuming that there is consensus as the goals as well as the priorities in the outline that was provided. So Amanda, do you see any, or anyone see any hands up?
I don't see any hands up. I do, well, when we get to public comment, there is someone.
Okay, I'll go to that.
I'm sorry, Chair Natalia. Jane Reed has raised her hand.
Okay, very good. Jane, go ahead.
Sorry, thanks for the late chance to ask a question.
Okay.
Is there a plan in this to sort of to monitor and track how we progress towards these goals?
Jeff, Campbell.
There are a series of, thank you for the question. The work of the Restoration Subcommittee is in some ways linked to the proposed ecosystem amendment to the Delta Plan, which does propose a number of performance measures that will help to track the progress of implementation of these recommendations over time. So there are metrics that are established that are speaking more to ecosystem health that we would be able to then track sort of from the beginning of these efforts to a midpoint to hopefully eventually a conclusion of the efforts to help track that progress.
Thank you. Yes, thinking about the mission statement or the vision statements and thinking about those are hard to measure, but they're important to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Jane. Any other member of the DPIC committee?
Yes, I see Secretary Ross's hand is raised.
Okay, Secretary Ross.
Hi, Supervisor. Thank you. First of all, I just have a question on permitting, because oftentimes that's one of the things that takes quite some time. And just wondering how some of the work that sustainable conservation has done on permitting to bring it more coordinated, if that is going to be an issue or not. But in general, I think this is really well done, and I really appreciate the presentations today. It's such important work, and to see it really scale because of this kind of interagency collaboration, it's exactly what we would all wish in every region of the state. Thanks.
I would just say that we're very optimistic that the work sustainable conservation is doing is going to benefit us all in the system. We also talked within the Restoration Subcommittee about getting presentations from other systems, the BRIT, Bay Restoration Implementation, I forget the rest of the acronym, sorry. But it is a forum where the agencies that do permitting come together and work very collaboratively to help usher through the permitting process in a more efficient way. And so we want to learn from those opportunities and think about what makes most sense. But that will definitely be a continuous focus for the Restoration Subcommittee.
Thanks.
Thank you. Secretary Ross? Yeah, any other questions?
I don't see any other hands raised from committee members.
Okay, very good. Okay, we'll step back for a moment here and then take public comment. And Sally, do you have a public comment or two?
Yes, we do have a public comment. Can we move over Gil from the participation list?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Gil. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair Natoli. This is Gil Bercosio from River Delta Consulting, and I appreciate these goals. You know, I've been watching this restoration subcommittee the last two meetings, and it's kind of exciting. Things are moving. On the other hand, when you look at Chapter 4 of the Delta Plan, landowners can see if they've got a target on them or not. And so as far as goal number 4, is there any thought of trying to work with those landowners and or reclamation districts, because they're all within current reclamation districts, to start talking about what the plan might do? I mean, I appreciate goal 4 because of forums and, you know, people have input, but like I said, the people that are at ground zero, so to speak, kind of can see that on the map. And I'm raising this issue because there's a lot of work going on in the Yolo Bypass right now, and those landowners were told that DWR would work with them and they'd come up with some sort of solution. And then lo and behold, they find out that they're going through eminent domain. So this is just a comment that if you could do anything to kind of prevent that from happening in this, I think that that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Gil, for your comment. Gil, are you, Campbell, you or Jeff want to respond to that?
Yeah, I would just quickly say that you know, that really is the hope for the community forums, and that is to at least as a starting point, really start with you know, what is envisioned in the Delta, what are the current targets, and where are we currently in terms of restoration in the Delta, and then really drill down more into things that are happening more in the near term, and then try to provide an opportunity for them to engage on those concepts and those potential projects. We know that that's a challenge. We know that it's going to be hard to get the Delta community to actively engage and come and participate. So, Gilbert, I know you've attended, and we welcome your thoughts and ideas about how to make that agenda as compelling as possible and target it as specifically as possible to what we know are the concerns and try to get people out and have that dialogue. So appreciate your participation.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Gil. Point well made. Any other public comment?
No, sir. No further public comment.
Okay, thanks. All right. Bring it back then to the committee here. This is, and again, thank you to our subcommittee members for their work on this. And I think certainly noting concern under public comment, is there, man, I'm not sure how we haven't done this, chaired this body before, so we just do this through consensus. Do I ask them if there are any objections, any modifications? And I don't know that we call for a vote, but ask for some guidance on this, Amanda.
Sure. Yeah. And before that, Secretary Ross has.
No, I was just going to ask, did you want a motion? I was just okay. I'm happy to make it.
She's ready to go. Okay. Thanks, Karen. Hang on just a second. So is that the appropriate way to do this?
You know, I think that's fine. You know, we don't generally take votes because it's, you know, we're non-regulatory. This is all kind of non-binding, but we do want to show some movement, some general support from the DPIC body for what we're doing. And so generally, yeah, just some mention that, yes, we are generally supportive. And then I think in the past, chairs have asked if there have been any, if there's been any objection to what's been put forth.
So do you go through your committee members one by one as you did in introductions, or just, no, we don't, okay.
No, so I think if Secretary Ross would like to make a motion of sorts, that would be great. And then we can ask if there is anyone who objects.
Okay. So I'd like to hear if there are any objections. I would make a motion. If one's not necessary, that's fine.
That's fine. We can accept the motion. And then I think to your question, Secretary Ross, are there any objections or modifications that would be suggested? We have a motion. We can do it by unanimous consent, I guess, if there's not any objections. But any hands?
No hands have been raised.
Okay, so then we'll move by Secretary Ross. Let's take a second, then we'll do unanimous consent. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, all right. Seconded by Mr. Ingram. And unless there's any objections, then we'll, noting the motion that and the recommendations as outlined in the vision statement with the goals, again, as I said, noting the concern under public comment, we'll unless there's any objections, then we'll, by unanimous consent, to go forward with the recommendation as outlined here. Okay. Then we do have action on that. So
thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Campbell. Thank you, Secretary Ross. All those that have contributed to the work of the subcommittee, and it gives us a structure to work from. And in the event that there are adjustments to the goals and or to the work moving forward, obviously it could come back to this committee at any time. So, okay, very good. All right, then with our thanks to our presenters on that one, we're gonna move to, and I know we're getting just a little bit behind on our agenda here. We have the next item is our under Delta Science. We have a salinity management presentation that's led by Dr. Larson and Karen Kafetz, who is program manager from Delta Science program. And they'll present the motivation behind this, and then tell us, you know, how we might also stay involved as committee members. And then we'll go to committee members for any questions or comments. So, turn to you, Dr. Larson, and to Karen.
Thank you, Chair Natoli. And we're here today to seek feedback from DPIC, as well as making DPIC members aware of a series of salinity management workshops that are coming up over the next year. I'm going to go through the slides really briefly, given that we're behind on time and really want to seek this feedback. But before I do, let me just invite Karen Kafetz to show her video and briefly introduce herself to DPIC. Karen is a program manager in the adaptive management unit in the Delta Science program.
Hi, DPIC members. Karen Kafetz, thanks for the introduction, Laurel. Really happy to be joining you today to discuss this topic. It's been a few years since I gave a presentation to the DPIC, and it's nice to see how engaged you all are on the range of new topics that we're covering. So I'll hand it back to Laurel to do our presentation, and I'm really excited to hear what input you have for this process.
Thanks, Karen. And let me just say that the context for this salinity management workshop comes from a lot of what we've been talking about already today, the need for long-term anticipatory planning in order to determine how to sustainably manage our estuary in the face of rapid change. The science needs assessment endorsed by DPIC is one way that DPIC has really grappled with this need. And of course, the science needs assessment talks about the need to develop a collaborative and formal Delta Science enterprise, for example, a forecasting or prediction center to address the growing number of problems which span agency missions. This issue is also encapsulated in the 2022 to 2026 science action agenda that I talked about earlier. And one type of rapid change that has been at the forefront of all of our minds is drought. And I'll just point to this Nature climate change paper that came out very recently in 2022, which suggests that the southwestern portion of North America is in a mega drought, the likes of which have not been seen in 1200 years. Well, we know here in the Delta that one of the most challenging aspects of managing the Delta during drought conditions is the challenge of managing salinity. The good news is that we have a lot of tools in our toolkit. In addition to the barriers, like the barrier across the West False River that we've seen installed in 2015 and this past year, we also have operable gates. We have the Delta Cross Channel. We have nature-based solutions, which DPIC has talked about at length over the last year. This video that you're looking at here shows the Franks Tract, an area that is critical to salinity in the Central and South Delta. Just for context, the West False River that you're looking at here in the barrier is located right here. There was a project called Franks Tract Futures. I know many of you are aware of this, that was commissioned or developed in order to deal with the challenges of managing this region for salinity, minimization of invasive species and harmful algal blooms, and recreation. And let me just go ahead and restart this video here. And one of the outcomes of that collaborative shared visioning process was the finding that wetland restoration configured in a certain way was actually quite effective at reducing salinity penetration into the Franks Tract. Now, this issue of nature-based solutions as a possible tool on top of regulatory actions, flow actions, and demand management, this issue of wetland restoration scales too. When the Delta Science Program ran a salinity workshop in 2018, Deanna Serena of Contra Costa Water District presented this slide in which she showed how when wetland restoration, when tidal restoration habitat is placed away from Suisun Bay, salinity decreases in the South and Central Delta. But when it's adjacent to Suisun Bay, it actually increases in the South and Central Delta. So as we plan to implement thousands of acres of wetland restoration, it's worth considering how careful planning might have multiple benefits for salinity. And hopefully we keep that as benefits. So our long-term goal in this series of workshops is to seek collaborative solutions to controversial challenges of managing salinity in the face of drought. And let's face it, salinity management is really hard. There are distinct winners and losers associated with our management actions. Collaborative visioning processes ensure that voices are heard before a project or a strategy is designed. And these processes build more transparency into modeling. They give communities ownership over the solutions that are designed. So through vesting various voices in the modeling process, shared visioning helps make all parties familiar with the science and what it says about the pros, cons, and limitations of each of the alternatives. And they could bring these parties to a position of compromise and or consensus. And just the background photos here show this some snapshots of the shared visioning approach that was undertaken as part of the Franks Tract Futures project. So what we're trying to do with these two salinity management workshops that Karen will soon present is to catalyze a collaborative adaptive management approach to controlling salt intrusion in the face of severe and sustained drought and sea level rise, and really to evaluate how these suites of tools that I just talked about might play out in the long term when we consider that sea level is rising and that the tidal prism could be changing as well. So Karen, I'll turn it over to you to say a few words about the workshop goals and structures.
Thanks, Laurel. I think the presentations that you all saw just before in the panel actually did an excellent job of illustrating how complex it is when you look across the system, all of the different factors that change as you manipulate the nature, the engineering, the flows, the operations of the system. And so that long-term goal that Laurel just spoke to, that's not something we're all going to accomplish within a year. We can't accomplish that entire adaptive management framework in a year, but we do have a short-term goal within 2022 to have these two workshops and to achieve these interim goals with those two workshops. So we want to build a shared understanding of the range of issues associated with ocean salt intrusion in the Delta. And this goes beyond just species that we manage for, special status species. This is about the people who live and work and play in the Delta and how salinity management affects them. It's also about the people who live outside of the Delta and rely on water that comes from the Delta to be fresh. The second thing we want to do is to identify some of the knowledge gaps that must be filled. And this could be with research work and setting some research priorities for future funding and implementation of that research to fill those gaps. It will also certainly be, because of the design of our exercise, to do some knowledge gaps related to scenario-based modeling work so that we can continue to understand those complex interactions of factors like Laurel was talking about in her introduction. And then the third, of course, is laying this groundwork for the collaborative adaptive management approach. So there's a lot of consensus building and discussion that we need to do to understand how people want to come to the table and how they want to participate in a collaborative adaptive management framework before we start putting anything into our actual governance. So Laurel, please advance. Thank you. So this is our timeline for what we're going to be doing in 2022. We're starting this process very soon. In 1 month, we'll be hosting a first public workshop. It's taking place over 2 days, 9 a.m. to about 3:30 in the afternoon for 2 days. And we're going to use this time to really frame the challenge and build towards a shared understanding. We have a mix of panel discussions and breakout group discussions so that we can identify people's values as well as their ideas related to this topic. And we'll start a conversation at this meeting about a scenario-based salinity management exercise. And we're going to continue on with that during the summer. So we'll have some focus working group meetings over a range of different dates in the summer to meet in smaller groups with the interested agencies as well as individuals from the public, to have discussions diving deeper into the details of these management scenarios and deeper into discussions about what are the impacts and trade-offs on the people or on the species or on the other resources that we're looking at managing for. And our expectation is that at the end of these focus working groups, we'll have more information about some of the scenarios that we could be evaluating with computer models that people would be interested in learning more about. And then finally, in the fall, we'll have another workshop where we come back together and we discuss the outputs of some pilot model scenarios. Now, we're not going to be able to model every single permutation, every single thing that people are interested in. The idea here is to come up with a few representative scenarios that will allow us to have deeper conversations about the trade-offs that are inherent in different strategies. And that will help us refine the ideas about those research and scenario-based modeling priorities that I discussed earlier. So Laurel,
Yes, and I'll just say I'm going to skip over these two slides. I just wanted to show that the planning committee does consist of representatives from a diversity of agencies, both within and a few outside of the Delta. And we are convening a modeling subcommittee to work on the pilot modeling exercise that also represents several key agencies in the Delta. In terms of how DPIC members can contribute, I would request that you encourage your staff to participate in these workshops. Registration for the April 26th through 27th workshop is now available. And then after the workshop, we will be reapproaching DPIC, asking for an endorsement of a charter for this long-term collaborative visioning process that Karen just talked about, where endorsement implies an openness to consider the findings of the trade-off analyses we will be doing in your planning processes. And then today, if there is time, and I'm just going to put all these up here, if time permits, we would like to seek your feedback on questions relevant to this April workshop and to the pilot scenario exercise that Karen discussed. And I would say the first three questions here are really our priorities. I know we're short on time. I will also welcome responses via email.
Thanks, Laurel. Thanks, Karen. We do have a couple of minutes here. And again, I think if with these up on the screen and certainly with the workshops, you know, just a month away, and then obviously work through the summer and back in workshop setting in October. Let me just go to committee members here. As you look at what's on the screen or think about this, and as Dr. Larson said, certainly follow on, you know, even after today's committee meeting would be welcome. But let me ask if there are any hands up or any thoughts along the lines of the discussion questions and anything that might be covered in the workshop setting. Bob or Amanda, any hands
yes.
up?
Yes, Jane Reed just okay. Raised her hand.
Very good. Go ahead, Jane.
I'm on again. I just want to say thank you so much for doing this kind of work, Laurel and Karen. I think this is really a wonderful way of sort of bringing together a lot of different ideas and a lot of needs to think about this. And, you know, as USGS, we're very interested in being engaged in the best ways we can. I'm going to default on these discussion questions because I think you've got the best USGS minds working on this already with Anka and Lisa helping along. And that I just want to say thank you. I'm very pleased to see this kind of work coming out of the Stewardship Council and the Science Program and others. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I don't see any committee members, but I do see public comment.
Okay, very good. Okay, we'll give one last shot to committee members. Let me go to the public comment then. Item. So please introduce yourselves and Bob or Brandon will unmute you.
Yes, we have one from Gilbert Cosio as well.
Great, okay. Yo, welcome back.
Yeah, I hate to monopolize your public.
No, comment, go ahead. Go ahead. Thank you.
I just want to say one thing. You know, I was recently on in a stakeholder group representing Delta interests, talking to the state, which resulted in the current drought water conservation pilot program that Campbell Ingram's group is ministering. And I think the thing that brought us all together was that one thing we can all agree on is that the important of water quality affects everybody. And so I really applaud that you guys are looking at this because it does, you know, it's one of these things we aren't going to argue about too much, you know, tunnels and whatnot that we do argue about, but the water quality, it benefits everybody. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, one of the things we're working on also in the North Delta is that DWR is looking at designing positions for North Delta barriers if and when they should ever be needed in the future. And to DWR's credit, they invited our comments because we were really critical of what they were trying to do in 2015. And lo and behold, we were able to spot the barriers in an area that benefits as many Delta interests as possible. If you're upstream of the barriers, you're in good shape. Downstream, you're not as in good shape. So whatever you can do to engage the Delta water agencies, I you know, ask you to do that because there's a lot of good comments that would come out. And again, this is one of those things we can all agree on. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Gil, for those comments. I think it goes back to what Dr. Larson was saying a moment ago, too, that about just the work and working together and, you know, where you can maximize certainly the positive impact, recognizing that, you know, anytime you take on action that there will be impacts. But I think, you know, how you measure that and engage folks early on is really, really important. So thank you for those comments. Anyone else?
There's no further public comment, sir.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Okay, bring it back to the committee. One last opportunity here to offer any comments or questions. If not, you see them on the screen, and Dr. Larson, and I'm sure Karen will welcome those right up until start time on the 26th and 27th, but certainly throughout the course of the summer. And I think as the work proceeds, we'll welcome those comments. So, very good. Okay, again, thanks, Laurel. Thanks, Karen. Good to see Karen back at it. And Amanda, anything else on this item?
I think we're good.
Okay, all right. And certainly not to in any way rush our last presenter. I know we're getting close to the 3 o'clock hour, but we have one final item on our agenda before we take any closing remarks and any thoughts about what we might add to future agendas. We have our Delta Plan Performance Measures 2021 year in review. And this is going to be led by Martina Kohler, and appreciate Martina's preparation for this. And I'll let her get underway. Martina.
Good afternoon, DPIC members. So in the few minutes left, I will present the Delta Plan Performance Measures year 2021 in review. This brief report will highlight only a few of the key changes we observed with respect to the Delta Plan implementation. And I will also show where additional information and full reporting can be found. Next slide, please. A quick starter, what the performance measures are and why we use them. The council uses the performance measures to track progress in achieving the objectives of the Delta Plan. The performance measures are based on monitoring data and science to track where we are between the baselines when the Delta Plan was established and the targets in relation to the Delta Plan core strategies and measurable objectives. Next slide, please. The next two slides are on the process of selecting and establishing the performance metrics, baselines, and targets. The selection criteria included must be based on available monitoring data and science, must be relevant to Delta management, and must be linked to Delta Plan objectives and core strategies, and to support the Delta Plan adaptive management. Next slide. And the development of and refinement took about 5 years. The technical development included science consultation with the Delta lead scientists and the data science program. It included vetting with agencies and stakeholders. The Delta Independent Science Board commented on the performance measures process. And the process also included independent external technical reviews. Next slide. All the Delta Plan performance measures are available to be viewed and to access the data on the web-based dashboard. This includes the latest updates on the measures, the data visualizations, and also the deeper context information. The dashboard is organized by main resource areas as is the Delta Plan. Next. Now I highlight specific performance measures updates. First is the reliable water supply performance measures. This set of the performance measures is based on urban and agricultural water management plans. These plans are submitted to the Department of Water Resources by water suppliers statewide every 5 years. And before these submissions, DWR provides the guidelines with updated methodologies for the reporting. So the 2020 Water Management Guidebook included for the first time a methodology for calculating reduced reliance on Delta water. And so as a result, urban water suppliers that receive water from the Delta could use this framework in 2021 for documenting and quantifying the reduced reliance on Delta water. And this is important because water suppliers can document expected measurable reductions in reliance on the Delta water and improvements in regional self-reliance. The reduced Delta reliance element is new and still voluntary. The reported data are currently being processed and are anticipated to be available later this year. Next slide, please. Moving to Delta water quality and ecosystem, the water year 2021 was the second driest water year in recent history. So this means the freshwater flow into the delta was lower than usual, and consequently, the salinity intrusion into the delta was harder to manage. So we just heard some presentation on that topic. So delta salinity performance measure tracks how well salinity standards are being met in at compliance locations. In 2021, salinity standards were exceeded at locations in the delta in Susan Marsh. So this reflects that during severe drought conditions, it is challenging to maintain low salinity in the delta. Next slide. Invasive species is a very important management issue in the delta. A newly establishing aquatic vegetation species this year is the ribbonweed. It's a submerged aquatic weed. Ribbonweed has been spotted in few locations in the delta, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture is assessing invasiveness rating for this weed, and it likely will propose the second highest rating. The other species on the watch list is the nutria. Nutria has been actively controlled in the region with the goal of eradication, and this year's numbers indicate success of the program, and it's a hopeful sign that nutria numbers are lowering. Next slide. Toxic algae present in the delta waterways are important public health concern. The performance measure tracks locations of harmful algal blooms, voluntary sightings. These incidents are then confirmed and assigned a public health advisory level. So here, the HAPS report in the delta have almost doubled in 2021 as compared to 2019 and 2020. Next slide. The Delta Display's performance measure to feature today is the Delta Tourism, and specifically recent data on visitor seasonality and Delta Tourism peak season. And this is important for expanding opportunities to encourage recreation and tourism, which in turn contributes to Delta economy. Next slide. And the last performance measure is the risk reduction. This is represented with the performance measure on flood-related casualties and damages. The 2021 calculations of expected annual fatalities and annual property damages were reduced by 50%, which means that we met the performance target. The reduction is based on new hydrology and elevation data, but also a decade of levee improvements. So this shows that the need to continue improving the data and methods for evaluating the flood risk, but more importantly, investments in delta, in the levees remain important, especially in the flood-prone delta region. Next slide. And so kind of in conclusion, these were just few of the significant changes we observed in the performance measures, kind of reflect what is happening in the system. This is the third year of using these performance measures to evaluate implementation of the delta plan, but also external conditions that had to be accounted for in the interpretations. So this is still early in the process to be able to statistically, to see the statistically robust kind of trends across the older resources, but the value is in the kind of continued monitoring across the performance measures portfolio and contributing to understanding how to manage this complex system. More details for the year in review and associated data visualizations is available on the dashboard. And the website also features accomplishments page where completed actions by the DPIC agencies are also highlighted there. Next slide. And so with that, this is, I would like to close my presentation, and yeah, I don't think we have time for questions, but thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Martina. And we got maybe just a minute or two if there are questions. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into this, and you did a very admirable job moving through a lot of slides with a lot of information that's very, very important to certainly current status, but how we're tracking and measuring a performance in a lot of different areas. So let me just ask if there's any quick question or comment for Martina and her presentation.
I don't see any hands raised.
Okay. All right. Well, no indication of the importance of your presentation, Martina. And thank you so much for keeping us apprised. Again, I think it helps all of us and all those who've contributed, obviously, to any of the work that's measured in the performance measures. So Amanda, that brings us to, public comment, excuse me. Any public comment on this item?
No, sir. There's no public comment.
Okay, great. Okay, then that brings us to the end of our presentations for the agenda, but this is an opportunity before we close out today's DPIC meeting to ask of committee members if there's any items or topics you want to be assured we consider for the next meeting, which is scheduled for July 18th of this year. So this is your opportunity if you want us to consider agenda items for the next TPIC meeting. Amanda?
I don't see any hands raised, but I'll remind folks that we will do our pre-DPIC meetings probably May and June in preparation for the July meeting. And so, and then there's always an open phone, open email policy. So if you have any ideas between now and then, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Great. Well, it was information packed today. I know I learned a lot, and I hope all of our partners have some takeaways from today's session and a lot of good and important work that's ongoing. And certainly the coordination and collaboration is represented here in the DPIC meeting. And thank you all for being with us for the past 2 hours. And thank you, Amanda, for helping to shepherd the agenda and all the various presenters. One more big thank you to each of you. So one final call. Any questions or comments before we close today's agenda?
Seeing no hands raised.
Okay. Everybody is amazed and in awe. So, okay. Thanks once again for being with us, and welcome to those who joined us for the first time. And I don't know who will be chairing this in July, but nonetheless, thank you for your patience today and for your participation and for all the good work that goes on each day and for our comments as well. So with that, Amanda, if there's nothing further, then I'm going to go ahead and adjourn today's DPIC meeting, and we'll put it in the record books. We'll have summary notes at the July meeting. And again, welcome your participation throughout the year. So thank you very much, and we will adjourn. Thanks, everybody. And thanks to our technical folks, too.